chair, folks, and stay tuned for College Field Broadsides, the June 28, 2001 show with Robert Norris, that's on, and lots of other voices. Now, we'll give you a few of your live interviews on 6.3.
You'll be limited to 3 minutes. Are there any members of the public who would like to come forward and participate in oral communication for the Redevelopment Agency?
Council members Robert Norris, Huff, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, and members of the public watching at home. The council shows its persistent and methodical contempt for the public for the last 40 minutes by continuing with items from the previous agenda in clear violation of the written agenda here, which actually is very specific. Acting Mayor Crone read it a moment ago, and that agenda simply states, the Redevelopment Agency will meet at the close of the 3 p.m. council session or 4 p.m., whichever comes first. Making people wait 45 minutes denies the council and the public testimony from people who could not wait during that period of time. Hence, Redevelopment Agency items that pass during this period are suspect, in my mind, can be overturned by court action. More important than that, you're simply showing what the public knows already, that you have utmost contempt for the actual process that is even written in your agenda. Housing is a key concern as the city police push homeless people from their own camps, bulldozing campsites along the riverside. And we can see this in terms of the low-income affordable housing project, which we'll be talking about later, but some general comments about that, about items not on the agenda. In at the start, in the initial ill-fated Seaside Company-friendly BSOL plan, Mercy Charities has had its Dolphin Lee plan pre-approved from the beginning, and what now is clear has been an intentionally misleading process. Mercy's allies and operatives deceptively claim first that there was no Dolphin Lee project, then they got the 1999 Scan Housing Committee to include it as the only detailed proposal. Next, former Mayor Catherine Byers, after laying down the company line in constituent meetings, if the tenants won't agree, there's always the buyout, did a This is not about the items that are specifically...
These are items that are on the agenda,
no,
so you can
no, this
speak
is background
later.
Generally about Mercy Charities housing. I'm going to be talking about those particular items, and I would ask that since I was interrupted, I be given an additional 20 seconds here.
I would ask you to stick to the agenda.
I am sticking to the agenda.
Please continue.
Again,
you can give him 15 more seconds.
I'm saying this. Former Mayor Keith Sugar swore up and down to Phil Bear and other supporters he would never vote for the acquisition of the Dolphin without guarantees. But then, after Scan did an about-face and demanded those guarantees, he simply voted to hand over the property to Mercy Charities wholesale in the fall of 2000. Crone voted to proceed with the demolition of the Rex Court apartments after the Seaside Company had evicted tenants there without relocation or replacement housing. The proposed project will serve significantly less people than that served by the prior apartments at a huge cost. It has been a classic example of the big lie by the missing Mayor Fitzmaurice, who has also dismissed opponents who point to links between Mercy Charities and Catholic Healthcare West as anti-Catholic. I said initially, this misappropriation of millions of dollars to an inside developer instead of furthering the needs of thousands of low-income renters and homeless people encourages people to pay no attention to this council whatsoever and to try to find some independent means of proceeding. I encourage people to
Your
come to council at 7 p.m., speak out on this issue, and speak out about the rights of tenants who are being bulldozed from the riverside then. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
We're talking to Russell Bates, who's the sticker man of Berkeley, or one of them. Russell, you're here on a sunny Sunday afternoon, but you're facing some sort of court hearing coming up, or someone is?
Yeah, there were 32 of us that were arrested at Wheeler Hall at the UC Berkeley campus last month protesting conditions for the people of Palestine under their relentless attack from Israel. And we have a court date coming up 2 p.m. May 23rd, Superior Court in Berkeley on Martin Luther King and Center Street, where we're going to be arraigned. Most of us have been charged with obstructing a doorway. Some people were charged with obstructing and resisting arrest. And I was, again, because I'm pretty well known as an activist in Berkeley, I was accidentally kneed in the nose by a UC Berkeley cop.
The name of which was?
Officer Teal. Officer Teal.
I think I've heard that name somewhere before, but maybe not.
Yeah, Teal was the one that, during the People's Park in 91, smashed Eli on the head, accused him of trying to take his baton out of his baton holder, and sent Eli to the hospital with a concussion, and Eli won a good settlement from that.
But Teal is still on the force.
Teal is still on the force. He's on the UC bomb squad. I don't know if he's on their SWAT team or not, but he's a well-known pig.
To say the least.
To say the least.
Okay, Russell, how can people, is there a phone number people can call if they want more information on this issue?
There is a website, Students for Justice in Palestine. Let me see, that's the organization. The website is justiceinpalestine.org.
Sehr gut. Thank you, sir. Anything you want to add?
Fuck the police.
I don't see that sticker here.
No, people kind of, that sticker ran its course. Right now I'm concentrating on the four stickers. I have divest from Israel, Israel out of Palestine, free Palestine, and stop U.S. aid to Israel.
Thank you.
Very welcome.
You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM, and this is, of course, Bathrop's Pierre's Broadsides, the Thursday show, 2 hours of civil rights talk, interviews, music, and sputterings, not to mention your phone calls. You're invited to call in at 427-3772. We had hoped to have two guests from Camp Paradise. Unfortunately, they weren't able to make the rendezvous point. We hope they're okay, and we do invite them to call in, and we regularly get calls from Camp Paradise during this show. For those who don't know, Camp Paradise is the self-managed, clean and sober, neat and tidy campground that the city council has been running such great circles around the issue for the last month, rather than deal with the fact that Santa Cruz has an emergency shelter crisis of epic proportions, a rent crisis, a profiteering crisis of epic proportions, 1,000 to 2,000 homeless people in the city limits alone each night, illegally sleeping and confronted with $54 tickets under the sleeping portions of the camping ban, the blanket ban portions of the camping ban, and, of course, the camping ban itself, the ban on tents and making a fire and providing for the necessities of life for those who are not blessed with the $1,000-plus dollars to rent a studio apartment or a one-bedroom or whatever is necessary, as the landlords rub their hands in glee and the city council runs in terror from the words rent control as the university gobbles up existing housing. And again, the city plays patty cake with the regents. This is Free Radio Santa Cruz. We don't play patty cake. We play hardball, and we invite you to come play with us. 427-3772. I'm your host, as I said, Bathrobe Spear Robert Norse. My bathrobe is off today, so you can see what's under my bathrobe, but it's going to cost you. Anyway, we got an incoming call here.
Hi there, you're on Free Radio.
Hello, Robert Norse.
Hey. Sounds like Gentleman Jim Costner there.
I like that. That's good. How are you?
I'm good. I'm trying to adjust the level so that I don't drown you out and then you actually get heard.
Uh-huh. Well, it wouldn't be the first time that I've been drowned out.
Yes. Well, don't drown.
it's an ongoing struggle in a land where they want you to drown from birth.
Well, I know you've been doing some... Hang on a second.
Some swimming in the courtroom.
Some swimming in the courtroom and some swimming against the tide as well. You've been doing a weekly session of the Vets Hall. Every week you've been doing a sort of an educational forum. And last Tuesday you had the famous Sarah Jane Olson, who the L.A. authorities have dredged up, 30-year-old charges against and ripped her from her family in the East Coast and taken her down to L.A. and have been putting her and her attorney through the mill for the last year.
Yeah, that's right. That's a horrendous case. It shows how far U.S. government goes to prosecute and persecute sincerely dedicated human beings involved in the righteous struggle for freedom.
Dig it. But let me not second guess what you're calling for. What's on your mind?
Well, I wanted to discuss the question of Camp Paradise. I wanted to make a couple announcements if I could, and like that, yeah. I wanted to say that on Tuesday night at the Vets Hall at 7:30, which is part of what Robert was mentioning, we've been doing the UEPLO has been doing weekly political awareness programs, community forums, and discussions.
UEPLO.
The UEPLO, which is a new organization in Santa Cruz, and that stands for the United Earth and Peoples Liberation Organization, which stands for the human rights of the community and the human rights of the citizenry on an equal level for human rights for everybody, equal rights. And some of the things that we're supporting right now are Camp Paradise, for example. Its rights to exist and to live and to not be prosecuted by the law, the unjust laws and practices and policies of the police department with its sleeping bans and camping bans. And as Robert continually to champions around in the community around the whole question of the repression of poor people in this community. And our organization is united with Robert in that we want the abolition of the sleeping ban and the abolition of the camping ban. And we want the preservation and the protection of Camp Paradise. And we want rent control, and we want a limit to how much landlords can exploit and rip people off, you know, on a monthly basis, as well as the end to police brutality, as well as the end to the drug war, as well as freeing political prisoners and other things. And on this Tuesday night, Robert Norse, the host of this radio show, will be at the Vets Hall, along with Danny Garcia from October 22nd Coalition, along with Evelyn Schoenfeld, who's an 85-year-old activist, who's a wonderful human being, who's with the Coalition to Free Mumia and All Political Prisoners, which meets on Sundays at 5 p.m. at Loudon Nelson Park. For those of you who are interested in freeing political prisoners, there's a meeting this Sunday actually coming up. Also, Steve Argue, who's a former Santa Cruz political prisoner, will be there. Also, Miguel Balderos from the Communist Party, Carlos Padilla from Students for Justice from San Jose will also be present. So, and also Hank Milstein will probably be present too. So if people are interested, please come out Tuesday night at 7:30 at the Vets Hall upstairs, room 23. And I wanted to mention that this Saturday at 10 a.m., there's going to be a broad-based organizational meeting in regards to how best to protect and preserve Camp Paradise and how to further the struggle to abolish the sleeping ban and the camping ban. And also that's at 10 a.m. at Camp Paradise this Saturday, and we encourage the activists and the organizers and the people to come out to that and to be supportive and to work together to resolve this problem. And also,
where is Camp Paradise, Jim?
Camp Paradise is, if you go, Denny's basically, if you know where Denny's restaurant is, on the end of Ocean Street, where Highway 17, Highway 1, and Ocean Street all meet up and join together, there's a Denny's restaurant. Immediately to the right of the Denny's restaurant, if you're facing the front entrance or the entrance of Denny's, is a street called Felker Street, F-E-L-K-E-R, Felker Street. You go all the way down to the end of Felker Street. At the end of it, you'll see a broad-based trail. And
that's the river, right?
That's the river, towards the river, and it's the trails immediately to the right of where the road ends, Felker Street ends. And you just go down towards the river, and you go to the right under the bridge, and about 3 to 5 minutes, you'll come across Camp Paradise, which is a very beautiful piece of land along the river. And so that's at 10 a.m. on Saturday. And then we mentioned Tuesday, and then we also wanted to mention one last thing, and that's Wednesday, so-called Independence Day, which is actually the title of the event. On Tuesday night, it's the Hypocrisy of Independence Day, U.S. Democracy and Its Myths, which is a broad-based theme, but it ties into the fact that the 4th of July is the Independence Day for citizenry, you know, so-called, for the people in this country, the so-called Americans in America, and the reality is that Independence Day, well, a lot can be said about it. On so-called Independence Day, at 12 o'clock at the town clock, we will be gathering in support of human rights for everyone in the community, in support of true independence for the people in the community, and independence to sleep, independence to live, independence to not be exploited, independence to not experience racism, independence for not experiencing oppression. True independence, we'll be promoting and trying to get the community to promote and unify the community around the various different demands that are going on. And we welcome people to bring their demands, and we're encouraging people to support the protection of Camp Paradise as part of the gathering and the demonstration and the march. On Wednesday, July 4th at 12 o'clock at the town clock, we'll be gathering and assembling. It's also in support of the abolition of the sleeping ban and the abolition of the camping ban. You might as well throw the downtown ordinances in that as well, and push for rent control and many other important fronts that we need to fight on. So,
Jim, you were in court this morning fighting a case you thought that had already been resolved around the issue of so-called resisting arrest when police kind of moved in on a bunch of boisterous but peaceful protesters at the Yugoslavia bombing protest in 1999. I guess five people were arrested. You were one of them. And this is your third round in jail for the same charge of resisting arrest, even though the actual basis for the arrest was there was no underlying charge.
It's as usual. The system tells one story, and I tell another. And the system says that I resisted arrest on May 22nd. I'm on probation, so I violated my probation by resisting arrest, and that I was convicted of resisting arrest for May 22nd, in which I went to jail during May 22nd, and then was released later on that night. I went to jail when I came back from the Seattle demonstrations. Again, I don't remember for how long, but it was a period of days for. For the same, resisting arrest conviction. I was given served time. They told me, as of today, that I was supposed to do 70 hours of community service work, and I was supposed to pay a $100 fine for this charge that I've already spent a period of days in jail for, that I believe was unconstitutional, unlawful, criminal, and amoral to begin with. So what I said to them, expressed to them today in court, that as I would exercise my rights to pro per, to represent myself, and that I would exercise my rights to take it to trial, they said that since I'm on probation, I don't have a right to a jury trial, even though it's a misdemeanor, and that it'll just be a meeting between the judge and myself, and in which case I'm sure they'll convict me of, find me not guilty of not doing the community service, the 70 hours of community service and the $100 fine, in which case I say that I will not voluntarily give them one penny, and I will not voluntarily work 1 hour for them. And if they choose to put me in jail, for that stand, then that is their choice, and I will not voluntarily, cooperate with them either on that case. But I will surrender to the devils and let my body be incarcerated for another moment.
Now, you also, as I understand it, saw a man in a set of jail pajamas, the orange pajamas are for the men and the darker red pajamas for the women. Who was there for failing to come into court on a sleeping ban warrant, not a camping ban warrant, but a 6.36010A sleeping
ban.
Section. And what can you tell us about that?
Well, from what I heard is that he he had been issued a sleeping ban ticket. He had not paid his fine, and they issued a warrant for him for not paying his fine. And then the warrant gave them the basis to incarcerate him and place him in their cage, in their custody.
Any indication of when that ticket was originally issued?
I didn't pick up on the date, because the man actually, they only went through a little bit of the process before. They didn't complete the process before I was already done and off on my way to the meeting.
Now, I know what I noticed this morning, I was in court a part of the time with you in Department 2.
Which I appreciate that.
Sure. The Commissioner Steve Siegel, who was at one time a public defender, a public defender, now is a commissioner, which is sort of a lower echelon judge. A lot of tickets are appearing for things like driving on a suspended license.
Yeah.
And there's this one guy who had a driving on a suspended license ticket, and he just sat there. He was as sour can be. He said, "I've already done this ticket. It's been paid for. They picked me up again. I'm missing work because..." But he seemed pretty sure about what he was saying and pretty sour about the whole thing. And Siegel actually let him out on his own recognizance. But, it struck me again that here you have a whole class kind of oriented court system where a lot of these so-called crimes are kind of make work for these shark attorneys who are circling the courts like big barracudas, and they're chomping down their meals, and their meals is public taxpayer money, and the big chunks of meat are the poor people that get to come in again and again,
and get ripped off from,
for driving on a suspended license and stuff like that. I mean, it's
absolutely absurd. It's criminal.
Yeah, it troubles me. Let me put it that way.
It's definitely not a democracy.
Well, listen. Anything more you want to say?
No, just I hope that people will come out to the meeting on Saturday and come out on Tuesday night at the Vets Hall at 7:30 and come out to the True Independence Day March for real independence for the people.
And where does that march start?
At 12 o'clock at the town clock this Wednesday.
Okay.
Yeah, and thanks a lot for letting me be on the air.
Thanks, Jim.
And those are three events coming up. A couple of news briefs on Camp Paradise, although I'm going to give it to you secondhand. As I said, I hope to have a couple of Camp Paradise folks in the studio with me, and they didn't make it down to the rendezvous point. But that can happen. It's a lot of things going in the lives of folks trying to struggle to move along. I hope Camp Paradise isn't in trouble. Rick was one of the people who was going to come, one of the new people. Camp Paradise has expanded. I'm getting a little contradictory information, but from 30 to 60 people are there now, and there's even a sign that says full up, although I was able to successfully bring one woman down there who lives in her vehicle, who really said she's going to be in trouble. Her license expires soon. She wants to be able to get to Camp Paradise and have a place to sleep at night that's safe and, if not legal, at least apparently supported by other people in the campground, a clean and environment that's nonviolent and in fact is safe. But what he told me was, what Rick told me, and I think he would have told all of us on the air, is that 3 weeks ago, Officer RoboCop Perry approached him in the Brantz Affordy parking lot of Albertsons, where his vehicle was sitting there. He was attempting to get it. He was getting it in order. St. Vincent's was going to pay for his smogging. He just recently purchased the vehicle. He'd gotten permission of Albertsons to park there, which is in accord with the exception to the camping/sleeping ban, that is to say both the sleeping and the camping bans, which make it permissible for you with a business owner's permission to park in a parking lot. It has to be written permission. He was parked there. Officer Perry, according to Rick, called him a homeless piece of shit. That's a quote. I asked several times, and he said that was what he said, and called over his five police officers when he objected to Officer Perry's language, his five police officer friends. Perry had been getting coffee at the drive-thru espresso up there at the Albertsons or nearby, and the Santa Cruz police called in the sheriffs on him as well, and so he just took his blanket and his food and apparently walked away from the vehicle finally. He has not been able to get his vehicle out of the storage yard. He has had to... It was $300 already by the next day, he said, and so he joined Camp Paradise. So here's another example, if his story is accurate, of police actually promoting homelessness and indeed producing an increase in camps. necessarily, because I guess police somehow have to think people will disappear from the world if they say that there's something wrong with what they're doing and start punishing them. This is some sort of twisted and wholly unrealistic mentality. And Officer Perry, who's notorious for attacking recycling people, who was really quite a terror on the mall when he was down there. This is one of our few, if not our only, African-American officer, and that is obviously, I don't think there's any connection with his skin color whatsoever, but that is, in fact, who he is in this situation. It's just not good, and it's an example of police out of control. It's an example of blank check laws that police are allowed to enforce against whomever they wish, and of course it's against the homeless that they get applied, because who else has to live in their vehicle? It is, of course, properly said that in many cities up and down the coast, Santa Barbara, Santa Monica, Los Angeles, San Diego, San Francisco, Eureka, and Santa Cruz, affordable housing is a car. Affordable housing, 2001, is a vehicle. And the fact that Fuhrer Fitzmaurice, as I called him at the last council meeting, and for which he had me evicted from the chambers for apparently perhaps striking a little too close to home, he called it hate speech. I call it calling repressive, narrow-minded, bigoted government leader, if you want to call him a leader or official, exactly what he is, in a fashion that he doesn't like after he's engaged in repressive behavior towards other members of the community. And I don't just mean homeless people. Fitzmaurice, at the last council meeting, and we're going to hear about this, hopefully I'll get this tape queued up in time, at the Tuesday City Council meeting, Fitzmaurice refused to extend oral communications for 1 to 3 minutes to allow the final speaker, who is a critic of his, Phil Baer, a Beach Flats activist and landlord, to speak. Baer was going to talk about the Tidelands and how the city golden-haired boys and girls elected as progressives, Riley, Porter, Crone, Fitzmaurice, Sugar, have all been dragging their feet on the Tidelands issue, that is to say, the issue that Baer himself was able to successfully expose, where the Seaside Company has been using as a parking lot public land for the last 5 decades, and the city is now supposed to be trying to get it back, not give it away to the Seaside Company, as, for example, Councilmember Kennedy wants them to do. And when Baer approached the mic simply to ask for an extension of time from this council that was elected on the premise of greater public participation and more open public process, Mayor Fitzmaurice told Baer to step away from the mic, that he had ended oral communication, that there was no chance to reopen it. He didn't even ask for a vote or look around other council members. It was just this tight, small, nasty little voice that is we've come to really to recognize as being Fitzmaurice's, and saying no. And I actually was up there at the mic coming up to pick up my tape recorder, which I used to try to, not too successfully often, to catch some of the oral communications, as is provided for and allowed and protected under state law, the State Brown Act, which is what's called the Open Meetings Act. You've heard me mention it on the air before. And Fitzmaurice, as he turned Baer away, I said something like, "Well, that's Fuhrer Fitzmaurice for you." And he then ordered me out of the chamber, and I said, "Thank you very much. Thank you, Fuhrer Tim. I'll be on my way. Yes, Fuhrer Fitzmaurice." And as I left, of course, he began denouncing the fact that I was using the word Fuhrer and comparing him to Nazi warlords in his policy of repressing free speech. And he actually, I think, got a misguided council to applaud him. And I think he made some statement that he was not going to allow that in the future. And that's an interesting statement, because calling someone Nazi-like in their behavior is a form of free speech. And indeed, if the individual is acting in such a fashion, it is essential to guard against that kind of behavior. You've got to be able to aptly characterize repressive behavior as repressive in the most dramatic way possible, or else you may find that you just don't have that opportunity anymore. And that's what we found increasingly under the Fitzmaurice regime. I mean, I was calling him Emperor Tim for a while. Fuhrer Fitzmaurice seemed a little hackneyed, but at his behavior at the last council meeting, for example, there was a woman with a sign in the back row, Susan of the Green Party. I'm not one of Susan's biggest fans on all issues. The Green Party has acted disgracefully in attacking me personally and in defending Fitzmaurice from keeping the party platform around the sleeping ban, as Fitzmaurice should be held to do. Instead, the Green Party has attacked those of us who've raised the issue as somehow, you know, casting mud on their fair green, on the mantle of their fair green mayor. But Susan was there with a sign that actually was a double-sided sign. One side said, "Can't support Camp Paradise." The other side talked about MUD, the Municipal Utilities District, that a number of folks had come to the last council meeting to talk about. And she was in the back row, and she had this little sign up. And Fitzmaurice directed her to put down the sign because the people in back of you can't see. And I was one of the people in back of her. And I was saying, "I don't mind, Tim. I don't mind. I can see." And he said, "One more comment, Mr. Norris, and you will be evicted from the chambers." So here is a man that he was going to protect. And what he actually was doing, of course, was trying to suppress political speech, control the behavior of the audience, intimidate people. And he had no particular concern with the rights of the public. That has not been his concern ever since he's been in office. His concern has been with a particular way of kind of like running his classroom. Fitzmaurice is an instructor of English literature, perhaps. I think that's what it is, up at UCSC. And I think he should go back to his classroom and stop trying to treat the rest of us like minors and realize that we are citizens here, that he is an elected representative whose real job is to facilitate discussion in the community and the best solutions to come out of community gatherings. And, of course, he has no interest in doing that whatsoever. It's been made perfectly clear by his behavior in the last 2.5 years. Secret meetings on the Dolphin Lee Project, that's the Beach Flats apartment destruction where all more than 5 years of affordable housing, more than $17 million in money is going to go down the drain to build less affordable housing than currently exists, to house less people than are currently there. It's been said time and again, yet Fitzmaurice doesn't ever address these issues, but moves lockstep in tandem with his favorite nonprofit, Mercy Charities Housing. And a little bit about that. Here's a discussion of that from more of the Redevelopment Agency. This is a meeting of actually 2 weeks ago when Vice Mayor Crone was acting mayor. And as you heard from the tape at the beginning of this session, acting just as badly as Fitzmaurice. What he was doing, he was nicer about it. You know, he had sort of softer voiced about it and less obviously repressive. But he, again, violated the basic agenda, which said at 4 o'clock, you go on to the redevelopment session, because otherwise people who have known it's scheduled for that time won't be able to stay. And he instead let other items go for 40 minutes. And when I brought it to his attention, there was no apologies. There was no, requesting of the audience if anybody had not been allowed to talk. There was no attempt to accommodate the public in any way. There was just this absolute, oh, this is coming from this pariah Norse. I don't have to talk about it. I'll just act as though it doesn't exist. So the only way that these people do talk about it is, as for example when Fitzmaurice was, they're hauled into court to testify by subpoena, as he was hauled into court to testify when for 5.5 months he kept me and 2 other people out of the city council offices through using the stalking horse of his administrative aide, Anna Brooks, claiming we were harassing her, when in fact Fitzmaurice and other city officials simply wanted to be protected from legitimate public inquiries into why he wasn't taking any action to deal with the infamous sleeping ban law and his failure to expand shelter a jot, to expand shelter by one floor space. Fitzmaurice is a phony, I'm afraid, and he's also a very repressive individual, and that's why I called him Fuhrer Fitzmaurice, and that's why I'll call him Fuhrer Fitzmaurice again, when and if it seems appropriate, which seems to be frequently. Anyway, here is a bit about the Dolphin Lee from the Redevelopment Agency meeting of 2 weeks ago. Again, this is the project where all your affordable housing money, which could go into building housing for people, is going to be dumped into a favorite project. So Mercy Charities Housing can raise this boondoggle project in the Beach Flats that serves less people than currently are served by the housing situation, or certainly than were served by several years ago before the council colluded in the destruction of the Rex Court apartments instead of their refurbishing.
We go to item number 2 on our agency administrative business. Beach Flats Affordable Housing, Child Care, and Community Center Project. We'll have a staff report. Who's giving a staff report? Cecile Cirillo,
yes,
from redevelopment.
At your May 22nd meeting, in connection with the approval, the action that was late in the evening that night, on the pre-development funding for Mercy Housing California.
This is redevelopment agency
members requested
Mistress Cecile Cirillo, who owns over, who makes over $100,000 a year,
Mercy
very highly paid city employee. She and Mercy Charities housing officials have pushed this project through.
We do have representatives here from Mercy, both Jane Graff, the president of Mercy Housing California, and Elizabeth Vogel, the project manager. Staff has no recommendations with respect to this item. It's provided for information, but we believe that you wanted to have some discussion on it.
Questions from council members on item number two. Councilmember Premack.
Thanks. Well, from the minutes, it appears that it was Ed who requested this information. I think I participated in that request, and my concern was not so much simply what the construction budget was for the project, but what the entire cost of this project would be. What the cost would be to the city in terms of land acquisition, relocation fees in terms of redevelopment. If the city's giving up right of way for this project, is there a value on that? What is this project costing? Not so much what it's costing Mercy Housing to build it, but what, you know, to just get a handle on what it's costing us to create 48 units. And that was the question that I think I had at the meeting, and I hoped that the motion addressed that. So what I see in the report is specific dollar amount, the Mercy's side, so to speak, of the project, but in terms of the city fees waived, all those things, that's not, I haven't seen it here, and I hope that we'll get answers to those questions as well.
Councilmember Porter.
Yeah, I have a couple of questions, and actually they are related to Councilmember Primack's comments. I guess the first one is, I'll just read from the center of page 2-4. It's important to understand that as the nonprofit general partner in a tax credit funded development, the general partner must fund the required contingent liabilities, including an operating deficit guarantee. I won't read the rest of it. So the nonprofit general partner is Mercy Housing, is that correct?
Yes.
So Mercy Housing will fund any operating deficit. Is that what this paragraph means?
I believe that we should have Elizabeth answer these questions because she prepared it, and I don't want to make any assumptions of what she was representing here.
Ms. Vogel, could you please come forward?
Elizabeth Vogel, the chief hack and PR person for Mercy Charities Housing, who generally has ducked significant
questions
about costs.
Hi, Elizabeth Vogel, Mercy
costs.
Housing, and Jane Graff, president of Mercy Housing, is here today as well. We thought you might be interested in understanding more about how the developer fee and guarantees and all work, and I'm actually hoping that Jane will answer more of that because she's much better at it than I am.
Councilmember Porter, the answer to your question is yes. We do expect and do stand behind our developments and provide guarantees to the investor, banks, et cetera, and they expect us to step up and make sure that we meet any obligation. And from time to time, it requires that we do step up to meet those kind of obligations.
So that's after completion of the project. That's basically talking about the cash flow of the project
that's
after
correct.
It's completed.
In that particular guarantee.
Okay, and then what about the actual development time frame? Actually, I'm just unclear, and maybe both you and the redevelopment director can comment. If there were growth in this project, what are the obligations of the parties?
And it gets pretty tedious, although there's some interesting dialogue from the audience, yours truly among them, essentially bringing up the same questions again that are really unanswered. They didn't present a full budget to the city council to let them know just how much money in terms of land acquisition, construction, fee waivers, etc., as Councilmember Premack pointed out, was actually being spent to create less housing than currently exists. And that was back on in early June. By late June, at the last council meeting, Actually, a week later, PREMAC voted to pass the replacement housing plan for this project, which enables them to roll forward with acquiring the property. That's what they need, a replacement housing plan. Even without meaningful tenant input, when a year ago the tenants had unanimously, at least in the Lee apartments, rejected the replacement housing plan that was proposed. And this was the same replacement housing plan. Now, since then, of course, the city has been running around with fear-mongering around rent raises, and it's not really fear-mongering. Certainly rents are going up, but not in the Dolphin and Lee apartments. And not in the Lee apartments that are the city doesn't control. The Dolphin essentially gave Mercy Charities Housing the money to buy the Dolphin apartments, and they're managing those apartments right now, and they've actually reduced rents slightly to their credit. But in fact, this is a PR measure to cover themselves so that within the year, when they start removing people from this housing and sending them on their way with a check, let's say, for some relocation funding, but nothing to cover what it would really cost families to live for 3 years here in Santa Cruz, they're not going to replace the housing for them that they're destroying, really. What's happening here is that you have, again, the same old situation. It's the bait and switch. It's the smoke and mirrors. It's the trust us. It's the check is in the mail. It's I'll pull out, please, I love you approach to dealing with public dialogue. And we've seen it for 2.5 years with these same, I want to say lying bastards, because that's how I feel about them, but let's say honorable council members who are elected to do just what the other council members, Rotkin and Kennedy and the candidates Steinau and Walton and Canfield's banker, Quartararo, we voted them down, we voted these people in, and we got the same old shit. You got the new clowns and the old circus, and it's the same deal. And it's really important to realize that it's now the community that has to speak up on these issues. And it has to speak up, of course, on all kinds of issues. And I know that this Dolphin Lee issue seems perhaps a little arcane to some folks. I mean, you know, this is one housing project in the Beach Flats. Why do I keep harping on it? Well, it's using up all the affordable housing money for 5 years in the city. And it's a perfect example of the kind of corrupt, completely buffered process that has no meaningful public input that has been going on, not just with housing, but with homeless issues, with protecting the police department from any meaningful criticism or real oversight, with protecting the redevelopment agency and getting it what it wants to do. There's no redevelopment agency oversight agency. It's all the city council, you know, does what its staff tells them to do. And you occasionally get a whimper from Sugar or Crone, but less and less. You know, and you get people like Porter who are elected on a Green Party endorsement to end the sleeping ban, who won't even put it on the agenda. And Fitzmaurice, a Green Party mayor who's supposed to follow the Green Party platform, who won't allow Ed Porter to put this on the agenda. But Porter himself won't return phone calls to homeless activists like Michael Schmidt and myself because he is afraid to deal and discuss these issues directly. And these people, as long as they can talk in their rarefied climate and they don't have to talk about real issues in a real public forum, they'll just do just that. They will continue to operate largely in secret or in a situation where the public gets 2 minutes to talk and they're ignored, and then they do what they're going to do. It's a sad day. So what I'm going to do is, first I'm going to play you a little poetry from Berkeley poet Julia Vinograd, who really, one of my favorite poets. She's written 42 or 3 odd books, and they're not a lot of books, great street poetry. And then we're going to hear a little bit from the City Council's oral communication session of last Tuesday at 7 o'clock, from which I was unceremoniously thrown out. And that's not really the high point. I've been thrown out of the last 3 council meetings. You might say, boy, aren't I a disruptive character? And the answer is no. I don't particularly like getting thrown out. I don't particularly want to be thrown out. But, I mean, you either have to sacrifice free speech and shut up, or you have to risk repression from the chair. And I generally choose to risk repression. And I don't do so in what I feel is a disruptive fashion. I do so in a fashion to inform the public and to characterize what is going on. And as you just heard, the last time I was thrown out was because I said something along the lines of, that's how it is with Fuhrer Fitzmaurice. after he had repressively refused to extend oral communication time, even to consult the rest of the council for activist Phil Baer, the last speaker in line. Nothing would have been easier. I didn't know what Baer had to say. He and I differ on issues. He's a big fan of drug enforcement in the Beach Flats. I think that's a useless policy. But I wanted him, as a member of the public, to be able to speak. And I didn't think it was appropriate for Fitzmaurice to simply say no without consulting the rest of the council. Now, there's some who will say, well, why didn't you go up there and say point of order and make a kind of a gentle discussion? Well, last time I did, I went up and said, not point of order, I asked the chair, gosh, you know, doesn't the agenda say that there's a period of public comment allowed here? And Fitzmaurice just ordered me out of the room. The man has apparently a blank check from the rest of the council, no control from the city attorney, and there's no, apparently, as of yet, no investigation by the grand jury into what is going on here. And while I'm the one who... Whether you like the French revolutionary approach or the German National Socialist metaphor, it's everybody else's butt that is really getting kicked, because you, the public, are not going to be talking about what you need to talk about, because when he comes after me, he really is coming after you. I mean, it may not seem that way to you. You may think, I'd never do what that Norse character does. But when your issue comes up and you want to be treated fairly and you're not, you're not going to have any recourse unless you support others who are being turned away from the mic. It's the old, you know, when the Nazis came for the, you know, the Jews, I didn't stand up because I wasn't a Jew, and they came for the socialists, I didn't stand up because I wasn't a socialist, and so forth. And then when it came for me, there wasn't anybody else stand up with me, and they took me too. So, I mean, that argument, I think, is, you don't have to believe that there are concentration camps in Santa Cruz, although take a look at the Homeless Services Center sometime, to believe that it's still a useful metaphor. And to talk about people as Nazis, and I've never called Fitzmaurice a Nazi per se. I called him Fuhrer Fitzmaurice because of his behavior at that meeting. And is really can be considered apt based on what he's doing. So I do protest too much. That's my point of view. Let's hear a little of Julia Vinograd.
Good evening. My name is Jane.
Assuming, of course, we can find Julia Vinograd. Yeah, this is the right tape here.
Okay, we're in the Club Med with Julia Vinograd, the notorious poet. How are you doing, Julia?
I'm doing fine.
You have a new poem here, which you're threatening to read me, which I've asked you to do. Go ahead.
Okay, some friends of mine just got married. It's called Wedding Party. I went to a wedding in a park recently, and all our friends were there, even the dead ones. Before the wedding, they played a tape of the big, laughing, dead drummer whomping his pair of waist-high Congo drums like spanking the bottoms of baby gods that had been so bad. A dead biker's painting scowled ferociously at the long circle ceremony under the noonday sun, trying to convince everyone where he was hotter. Hell is a status symbol. But he always was a liar. Another guy came in a jar of ashes carried by his girlfriend. No way was he going to miss this wedding. The bride wore black silk trimmed with maroon lace, so low cut her breasts shone like headlights. But there were three other brides wandering around, at least one female. A magnificent 7 foot tall bridal drag queen in foot and a half platform shoes wrapped in a white satin sheet slit all the way up, strode sure-footed as a ghostly lighthouse. I could hear my ghost friend sailing back across the river Styx, sighting her full-length white veil on train and yelling, "Beer ahead!" Our friends were all the same age they were when they died, but we'd gotten older, a little less real, whooping secondhand shouts. There were stacked tables of steaming, grabbable chicken, coleslaw turning a little in the sun, many bottles of wine fighting a corkscrew with arthritis, and a maypole as well as the wedding with the same colored ribbons from the bridal altar. The untied shoelaces of time danced to high, sweaty, stumbling confusion. It was a good party. Everyone was there, even the living.
Whoa.
Did you hear any of that?
I did. I heard.
Did you hear any of that? The Med started going to town on noise.
The Med is definitely a noisy place to do this, but you have a way of cutting through the noise in more ways than one.
Well, that's very nice. I hope your listeners can hear it too.
Thank you, Julia.
Okay. Hi out there, everybody.
You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. I'm your eternal host at this time, Robert Norse. And the phone number to call in, should you choose to join the mad merriment, is 427-3772, 427-3772. It's free radio, and you can say what you want. I particularly hope you kind of address yourself to homeless topics or topics of civil rights. That's kind of what the show is about, but say what you need to. And again, 427-3772 is the phone number. A couple of updates. This morning we had the first meeting in about, gosh, how long has it been? Probably at least 5 or 6 months, of the Homeless Working Group. Not to be confused with the Green Party's Homeless Shirking Group, which is the group that spent its time attacking me and activist Becky Johnson because we brought to them the record of Tim Fitzmaurice, compared it with the platform of the Green Party on the sleeping ban, and said, what's up, folks? And got, of course, the answer, get the fuck out of town, man. And they weren't talking to the mayor. They were talking to people who had joined the Green Party to bring these issues to them. And, of course, they haven't gotten a straight answer from the mayor yet, and they haven't made a straight statement on the subject yet. This is the Green Party that postures as the people who want to support human rights in different areas and ecological balance and conservation and saving the environment, the party of Ralph Nader. But in Santa Cruz, it's the party of Tim Fitzmaurice, and I'm afraid that says volumes more. And, of course, nothing is being done. But the Homeless Working Group, the real Homeless Working Group, the one that began last summer when the safe sleeping zones were still on the city council agenda and had actually been passed at a first reading in the industrial zones, was formed by a number of us, including Michael Schmidt, who was then CEO of the Chamber of Commerce. We met every week. We tried to get the supervisors to open up the Emmeline Street parking lot for vehicular parking at night. We tried to get them to open up Almquist, to open up the county parking lot for vehicular parking at night. We tried to get the city to open up the police department parking lot or some of the city parking lots, and they had endless excuses as to why they couldn't do it. And there was no place, and they just had nothing to do about it, and they just got buried in the deep sixth. And even though the safe sleeping zones got the 3 votes of Crone, Sugar, and Fitzmaurice, and they got the 4th and 5th votes of Riley and Porter when they came into office, safe sleeping zones, abolition of the sleeping ban, modification of the camping ordinance, even expansion of shelter space has not appeared on the city council agenda. And you get Emily Riley saying the most ridiculous things. Maybe she's been eating too many of those baked goods. I'm not sure. But she's a baker. Emily Riley runs a bakery, in case you don't catch the reference or don't know, over on Mission and Laurel. And I suggest you go into her bakery and tell her she should either go back to the kitchen or start cooking up some decent legislation for homeless people. Either resign or get out of the kitchen. You know, I mean, either do something in the kitchen or get out of the kitchen is what I'm saying. Anyway, Riley has been saying ridiculous things like, good people are doing good things. Except that we don't see any good things. We just see the deaths of activists. We see people suffering. We see fightings and people airlifted to San Jose. We see the city going after Camp Paradise, although there's actually been some recent indications that there may be some progress in this area. We have an incoming phone call.
Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Hi, Robert. Ed.
Hey, Ed.
I don't trust this cell phone connection, but have you heard? I got the beginning. Is there any, like, have you heard anything as when they're going to go down there and I guess, you know, take them out of there?
Well, you know, it's interesting you should ask me that, Ed. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
There have been several dates in the papers. July 1st was the most prominent, and then we got Sergeant or Officer Seeley, that fine homeless officer.
Right.
One, the only thing to come out of the Homeless Issues Task Force that the council paid any attention to, more police.
Right. Or allowed to talk.
He came down and he said, oh, we could do it First, they were going to do it last Sunday, then they were going to do it on Wednesday a couple of days ago. July 1st was the time given in some of the, I'm told, in some of the written notices. But recently, according to second-hand accounts from attorney Paul Sanford, who spoke to Larry
right.
Templeton, and I don't have the documentation, but the word at the moment is that the city council or the city attorney or some city officials have apparently given supposedly written assurance to Camp Paradise that there's going to be some negotiation or a search for another property before they move. Now,
oh, bless them. There is some good in them.
Well, no. Before you start jumping up and down, I have not seen this document. I have not seen it, and frankly, even if I did see it, I would have to view it three times and check it for invisible ink.
Make copies.
Before I believed it. Yeah, and make copies and take it to a couple of other attorneys. The attorney who's covering this, Paul Sanford, and who is a volunteer person who is very well-intended. He's a sweet man, but I'm not aware that he's ever had dealings with the city council in this way before, and I think he may be rather credulous, and I have no, you know, personally bad things to say about him. He's doing the best job he can. Attorneys, you know, do what they can in these situations. What I'd like to see is an attorney get an injunction against the city from moving on this property that would provide some real protection rather than just sort of a, you know, kiss me before you fuck me approach
right.
By the city council. Now, it should
quit drilling on my back, too.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, it should be said also that I do not speak for Camp Paradise. I do not speak for Paul Sanford. I do not speak for the homeless community.
Yeah,
I speak for myself. I speak, and this is my perspective on things. So, for example...
But what better person to speak for Camp Paradise? But
well, somebody who lives there would be better, probably. I mean, they're risking their asses, and they have to, you know, they have to make those choices. I don't live there, but I have yet. Yeah, it's true. In 2 weeks, I'll be out of housing. If anybody has a room, please call
July
me.
July 15th, right?
That's correct.
Yeah.
So maybe if Camp Paradise is still around on July 15th, and if it still has room, that'll be great. So what I think Camp Paradise. I talked to Larry this morning. And other activists at Camp Paradise, other residents as well. And I think what my impression, and again, it's only my impression, and they may call in with their own thoughts, and hopefully they will, is that they want a fair deal for the entire homeless community. But of course, they're particularly focused on their situation, and they don't want to have to move from an area they've improved and they've taken care of, and they've made safe and healthy and useful and livable. Unless another piece of property is offered, which they're willing to pay rent on, by the way.
Right.
Either...
That's amazing. They're willing to pay rent.
They are. They've got, you know, people that got...
I wouldn't want to take it from them if I had something to offer them, but still, you know.
Right. Well, see, I mean, you got to remember that it's not like this fantasy that they're a bunch of bums, a DiCenzo cartoon
right.
fantasy of a bunch of addicts and bums who are just trying to suck off the population. That's a bunch of, you know, of crap. It's like the
right.
anti-Negro stereotypes, anti-Latino
right.
stereotypes.
They're all the same.
Anti-female stereotypes, anti-Norse stereotypes, you name it, man. And, you know, it's just not true. What is true, I mean, there are some people who are former alcoholics, some people who are recovering, and they help each other recover. I mean, I've never seen anybody drunk down there or stoned down there.
The poor
you know,
people are down and out, and they still have help for each other, you know. I went down there
right.
Saturday, did the little get-together,
mm-hmm.
and here it is, a fine old-souled woman, you know, in a wheelchair, you know, I'm thinking... You know,
Kay.
Look at the dignity, right?
That's Kay.
Kay, that's
yeah.
right, I forgot. And
mm-hmm.
she had this noble, old, you know, dog, you know, beauty. You know, I got him a hot dog for the poor bastard, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And it's just like, you know, it was a wonderful trip. You know, your speaking was great. At the end, the rabbi, you know, it's like they really put up, I don't know, it was very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I enjoyed it. And I walked away thinking there, it's like, God, why can't somebody help them, you know? Here I am, I live in my RV, and I want to help them, you know what I mean?
Well, I think people can help them, Ed, and I think I don't think that they're going to lean over and, you know, embrace the city council with a big kiss and a smack and believe that they're going to spread their legs and go under for the city council. They are going to wait to see some real action, and not just going to wait. I think they're going to continue to organize. Hopefully they're going to get a computer link down there. They have a cellular phone so that if the police decide to move on them anyway, and police have a habit of ignoring the city council and doing what they want, and they seem to have a mind of their own, or I don't know if you want to call it a mind, a will of their own. And so I think that the community has to really mobilize. And Larry today, as I understand it, as well as the rest of the community, have agreed that they certainly want to peacefully negotiate, and they intend to continue to be peaceful. They're not, you know, they're not warriors. They're peaceful people trying to live.
Right.
But they also want the community to organize to support them so that if at essentially a minute's notice or a 10 minutes notice, if there is a move on the camp, people rush down there with cameras, with videos, with tape recorders, even some of them with the willingness, as for example, I will be there, the willingness to join them and even be arrested.
I'm one of these.
If necessary.
I don't want to be arrested.
I don't want to be arrested either. But
my dog and my cat that goes too, right?
Right. So. I mean, people should consider what's happening. Not everybody can go up for an arrest, and it's not always the wisest thing to do. But I said I would do that because initially it may deter the city and the city police from ill-advised activity if they know they're going to have a lot of nonviolent Martin Luther King-style folks saying, "Take me to jail too."
I want to get on some list to be there, and I want to do something. It's like. It's almost like brings tears to me, because here they are, they're down and out, they're the salt of the earth, John Steinbeck would call them, right? They're trying, they're not asking for handouts, and they're being threatened in Sentinel articles.
Right. Well, I mean, it's a really kind of dirty game. You see DiCenzo characterizing them in these nasty cartoons.
Oh, did you see that?
You know, yeah. But I mean, the response, I think, has to be, frankly, what the threat they really pose is they're showing that you don't need highly paid social service bureaucrats, that homeless people can manage their own campgrounds.
They're self-sufficient.
They can help each other, and that they don't make the land dirtier. They don't make the land more unsafe. They make it safer than the tourists. They make it safer than the situation that was there before. And this is such a threat to the police department, because the police department doesn't, it doesn't survive on this kind of thing happening. The police department passed this law back in 1978. It proposed it to the city council, and the city council passed the sleeping ban and the camping ban pretty much largely as it is back in 1978 as a hippie control measure, although they, if you talk to Rotkin and other mythologists of the sleeping ban, they'll tell you that it was to help to deal with tourists and college students. No, it was to deal with hippies. That's what it wanted. They didn't call them homeless people in 78, they called them hippies. And people who lived in their vehicles, like yourself. So, I think people should come down at 10 o'clock on Saturday to join this kind of...
I'll be there.
Get together to find out what to do next. People, I think the camp has to decide in the event that there is a bust, and maybe there won't be. I
hope not.
I still can't believe that's the case, frankly, and
it
has to be shown to me. But because we heard the same lie back in 1995 from Scott Kennedy, from Daryl Darling, from Mike Rotkin about the Coral Street Open Air Shelter, the place on which Community House now sits near the Homeless Services Center.
That's a blessing. You've been around for years, and you know for what they are, and you scare them, It's like they're intimidated.
Well, it would be nice if I could intimidate them in that sense.
Oh, you do, but you know why? That's why they won't allow you to talk, because they know you're a cover puller, and you have facts and dates and times, da-da-da.
Well, I think there's truth in that, too. They definitely try to discredit what I say.
And you're intelligent. They're battling, they're not just battling a peer in vocabulary and words. They're superior, but anyway.
Yeah, well, anyway, again, 10 o'clock on Saturday. And also the Homeless Working Group, for those who are interested, I was talking about that a moment ago. This is the group...
Right, I missed that. I didn't know what was happening.
Yeah, Homeless Working Group is a group that Michael Schmidt is heading. He's a guy who really is, strangely enough, comes out of a bizarre conservative environment in the Chamber of Commerce, but he has been probably more radical even on the issue, more straightforward on the issue than council members and people of so-called scan ilk progressives who are really afraid to cross their scan masters. Ed Porter takes his marching orders from Marty Wormhout, the supervisor. Ed Porter, the council member, won't do any... He and others who committed themselves to working, for example, for this town hall meeting that was supposed to happen tomorrow, pulled back. He, Crone, and Riley refused to do it. First of all, they didn't want me involved, and so the Monday morning group kicked me out so that they would still stay involved, and I said, fine, you're making a mistake.
Oh, boy,
it's not going to do any good. And unfortunately, I was shown to be right. They wanted the whole subject of the camping ban cut out of the agenda, though they said they would accept the sleeping ban. And then Ed Porter wanted the subject of homelessness removed from Mike Schmidt's supervisor's race. Mike Schmidt is running for supervisor in the spring of 2002, and Wormhout, who has a horrible anti-homeless record, does not want to talk about homelessness. So she's directed all her operatives and all her pals, all her allies, everybody who's dependent on her patronage, that to have nothing to do with Michael Schmidt and nothing to do with any projects he's involved with. And Ed Porter, the big liberal, the Green Party-endorsed guy, the man who's supposed to give us a revision of the sleeping ban, you know, follows along in that same way. It's really kind of disgusting. And Ed, if you're out there, you know, have the guts to call in and say something about this. Stop your smirking and smiling and just get on the phone and either, you know, deny the charge or acknowledge it and explain it, you know.
Prove that you're wrong. Yeah, it's kind of, I can understand kind of because they're, you know, divide and conquer. It's like one of them speaks up, then they're going to be made an example of. So then before the fear kicks in, you know what I mean, to be out there standing alone, you know.
Yeah, I mean, and the other thing is, I mean, there's other things. These people still need lots of resources. They need to set up a phone tree so that people can be called very quickly if the police arrive. And they need to work on plans as to what to do if and when the bust happens so that, you know, after people are arrested, after the camps are either dismantled or they dismantle them themselves, what do they do next? Do they go to City Hall and start, you know, getting, you know, putting up a tent, having one person get arrested, then have another person put up a tent and get arrested?
I'd make coffee, like you said, on your list, you know.
Oh, the coffee plan?
Yes.
The idea of going downtown, setting up vehicles during the day, putting a mattress on top of a vehicle and going to sleep there. This is something that they don't have to do, that actually the rest of us can do who actually have the luxury of living in rooms and have our own vehicles that we don't have to live in. The problem with those of you who are out there, of course, is that, you know, your vehicle is more valuable to you because it's also your home. My vehicle, though it may be my home in 2 weeks currently, is not my home. So, you know, I can use it for other purposes. If it gets towed, I can go sleep somewhere else without threat of ticketing. But, you know, not for folks
who
are homeless.
Well, I could make coffee somewhere, then deliver it there or something.
Right. I mean, making coffee. I think I'd like to see people park
up. Cook something.
What?
Cook something, too.
Yeah, I'd like to see people parked up and down Pacific Avenue with mattresses on top of their vehicles during the day and serving coffee out of their vehicles at night. I mean, I think if this went on for a week, it would have the merchants in a complete uproar and the city council would have to take some action. No question about it. But, you know, I've been babbling about this for years and it doesn't really go very far. Now, who knows? If the city is stupid enough to move on Camp Paradise, maybe there'll be people who are pissed enough to do something like in this fashion. But I think it has to be organized beforehand. I mean, they could also organize as a mobile campground, like Camp Dignity in Portland, Oregon, which moves around the town, and or like Share, the campground in Seattle, Washington, which has been around for a year, which moves to different locations as the city tries to get rid of it, and they go to another location. Anyway, Ed, I'm sorry. Let you say something, and I'll let you go.
It's Saturday at 10, right?
Saturday at 10, then there's...
And you'll be there?
I will be there, and there'll be a 4th of July rally, I guess... Well, there's a Tuesday deal I'll be speaking at, which you heard Jim Costner announce at the Vets Hall at 7 o'clock on Tuesday night.
Okay.
And then there'll be another deal the next day at noon, March, in support of ending the sleeping and camping bans. Because while we're focused on Camp Paradise, and properly so, Camp Paradise only deals for 30 or 60 people. We're talking about 1,000 to 2,000 homeless people who face this kind of shit every night. So, anyway, thank you very much, Ed.
Thank you very much, Robert.
All right.
Take care.
Thanks.
Phone lines are open. Give a call to 427-3772, 427-3772, and hey, I'm going to do a little, play a few interviews, but if you got stuff you want to come on live with, well, we can do that too.
Back of Logos Bookstore on, today is the June 16th, I think. Talking to?
Ken Ohm.
Ken Ohm. Mr. Ohm, you say that Mad Dog Mike, or Mad Mike the Wonder Dog, as he sometimes calls himself, was in trouble with a police officer about a week and a half ago.
Right over by New Leaf Store, right in front of, on the corner to the side there. Officer Connor. The one that shot Happy Dine.
Oh, Connor Carey is his
Connor
name.
Connor Carey. Yeah. Okay. Right. Connor Carey.
Did you see this?
I was there. I wasn't there when he actually pulled over, but he was driving in a car, and he actually drove diagonally across to cut Mad Dog off because Mad Dog was wearing some headphones. And he had to stop him and give him a ticket.
Oh, he was on his bicycle?
He was on his bicycle.
Where did this actually happen?
Right on the corner to the side corner of New Leaf.
About what time of day, do you remember?
It was the afternoon.
And were you privy to the conversation? Did you hear what was said between the two of them?
No, not really. But I do know that there was a couple ladies there that were quite upset with the whole thing, who saw the whole thing, and they said they were going to register complaints, but I don't know if they ever did or not.
How do you know it was for a ticket for headphones or for riding a bicycle with headphones?
I mean, because Mad Dog stopped by afterwards, and he was filling in some of the details.
This is in essence his account. You didn't see the ticket, but this is what he said.
No, well, I saw the ticket, but I
you didn't read the ticket.
No, I didn't read the ticket. No, and he said he was going to fight it or beat it in court. He said it was BS and all that.
Now, how far away were you from this when this happened? Were you like sitting down or standing around or?
Yeah, I was standing around in front of the store, and I was just like 20 feet away.
And he was walking his bike, riding his bike in the street, on the sidewalk. What was the deal?
Yeah, no, he was riding his bike, and he made a right-hand turn right there, and
just going with the flow of traffic.
Yeah, well, they went on a bicycle.
Well, you know, that's a notorious spot for giving people a ticket for going the wrong way. They usually sit
there.
Oh,
no, he was going the right way.
Right.
He was going down the street, and he made a right-hand turn, and Officer Conley, right?
If you're thinking, there's an Officer Connor, and then there's an Officer Carey.
Carey, yeah.
I think it was Officer Carey. Did you see his badge, or did Mike say that?
Yeah, Mike said that,
so
and
he
recognized
he was taken
him.
To, okay.
Yeah, he was driving his car, and as soon as Mike went around the corner, he actually pulled his car over into diagonally in the other lane and cut him off, and left the car sitting there the entire time, blocking the lane.
Well, it was only an attempt to provide an object lesson to other would-be bicycle scofflaws.
I apparently, yeah. But apparently he didn't want to bother to even turn his vehicle around or go around the block or something and catch him. He had to do this maneuver where he just zipped right over and cut him off with his car,
so
and
he
immediately
was going the wrong way. And I mean, he was going one way. Did he move into the other lane to do this?
Oh yeah, he was coming from the light from the side of from near the bridge there. Mm-hmm. From the direction where he had shot and where he had gunned down Happy
John Dine.
And since Mike was going the opposite way, then he pulled across the lane with his car.
Don't you commend such bravery and initiative on the part of our local police officers? He found a stop law and he stopped him. Now, what's your problem? Oh, you're a bicyclist. That's what it is, huh?
Yeah, I guess I'm prejudiced for bicyclists.
Well, I have no sympathy with that kind of attitude. Officer, good work. Thank you, Ken.
Oh.
We have an anonymous... I would call you a flag twirler. What do you call that thing you got in your hand?
A ribbon.
A ribbon?
A ribbon.
A ribbon. It's a ribbon on a...
On a baton, a twirler.
And it's blue and red. And you're from Camp Paradise, right?
Yeah.
And you look pretty happy. You got a smile on your face. Is Camp Paradise making you really sad?
No, it's not. It's the most happiest place on earth.
What about the city's attempt to close Camp Paradise?
I think it sucks because we won't have nowhere else to go. We'll be sleeping on the streets like they already don't want. We're out of the way. Why not?
How long have you been there?
I've been there for about 2.5 weeks now.
Now, you went to city council a few days ago.
Yeah.
What was your impression of that group?
I like their attitudes towards the open opinions about it and everything. And vice person finally...
Mayor Crone
finally came down and looked at it and everything, and he approved of it. I think we're going to be able to keep it, I think. I have faith.
At the same time, cops raid three camps.
Your name?
Yesterday morning.
Tell me about it.
I wasn't there, but I was almost there.
Uh-huh. What did you hear?
Cops told them to get the fuck out.
Where were the camps?
In the woods, past the railroad tracks, past Highway 1.
And were these Parks and Rec or Santa Cruz Police, you know?
Rangers and cops. I don't know if they were sheriffs or Santa Cruz Police.
And did you talk to someone who came on up to the scene later, someone who was driven out? What was the deal? Uh-huh.
Man!
Well, bring him over. Let's chat. So do we have a survivor of the camp raids here? Now, you also said you're getting some petitions together.
Oh, I wasn't. Larry is. He's got petitions. He was out up on the streets today. passing them out and people signing up for it.
That's great. And these are petitions to save Camp Paradise?
Uh-huh. Yeah. It was all full-blown over down on that corner over there.
We're looking down near Borders. Now, do you think that the folks have said that they're willing to even go to jail for Camp Paradise? Have you heard that said?
Yeah, I would.
Really?
Yeah, after I go to my court dates, and I'm going to, yeah, most definitely.
We look pretty mellow. Before you came to Camp Paradise, you were rather depressed, right?
Yeah, I had manic depression.
Well, you look a little, you look okay to me, but of course, then again, I'm an old psychiatrist, so I have to give you a full examination. We'll do that later. What's your name?
Christina.
Thanks, Christina. Anything you want to add?
No.
Thanks. So we also got a report from a man who preferred not to be identified, who said his campsite was raided by police in a kind of a joint force that included a ranger, a deputy, a police officer, and some younger, apparently rookie trainer people. And this happened to a number of other campsites a couple days ago. He was awakened at dawn, didn't even want to talk about it. He found it so uncomfortable and unpleasant. And he said he was given no warning. He said there was no report of a complaint. They gave him no other place to go. They simply said, get going, or we're going to give you a ticket when we get back. And so he did. Well, we have the candy-sucking Dan Hopkins here, 10 o'clock outside Borders. Dan, you said you were enticed into coming to the vicious Camp Paradise?
Yeah, if my voice sounds funny, it's because I got two lightsabers in my mouth you gave me. But anyway, yeah, I went to the Camp Paradise. I read about it in the paper, and I was really, really impressed when I went out there. People were really nice out there, and they had the fish pond with the goldfish in it. They had made a fence out of limbs that were on the ground, and it was real nice. You know, it looked really, really organized, clean. And then they showed me their gardens, you know, like they had corn, and they were even growing tobacco over there, and all sorts of things. And they had a big bicycle shop. And anyway, so I was really impressed. It could be like a prototype for some other places where homeless people could set up things like that. And they have no drugs, no alcohol, and no violence. You know, that's I think they got four rules. I don't remember what the third one was, but I really liked it, and the people were real nice, you know. And I think they should actually be allowed to stay there because it's secluded, for number one. But number two is it gives people a place to live, and they're all happy. They seem to be all happy. And they got their compressor in there, that electrical compressor in there, the other day, so they could have electricity out there. And I heard that the city council said that they're doing something bad to the environment or something, you know, by having their tents there and things. And I don't think that's really true. As a matter of fact, from what I understand, they hauled out all kinds of trash from the drug dealers and whatever's happened there before. So they actually cleaned the place up. And then now they're trying to hang that one on them that they're messing with the green belt or something. And I just don't believe it. Now they're going to, I guess they're threatening to
evict them on July 1st.
Yeah, take them out on July 1st. I think it's totally wrong. You know, it's inhumane. You know, it's inhumane for sure to take those people out, especially as nice as they are and the good job that they're doing there. And keeping it clean and everything, and they're real hospitable.
You see their petition? They're circulating a petition.
Yeah, I did. I signed it. A guy came down here on the mall, and he's getting petitions. He'll probably do the same thing tomorrow. And I think he probably got quite a few signatures today, you know, because let's face it, you know, it's a really good thing. And I think it's I read the paper, one of the paper articles, I think it was from the Chronicle or something.
Ooh, that trashy Chronicle article.
Yeah, they did some really derogatory statements.
Well, they
in
cited
there,
that great authority, Michael Rotkin, one of the people that you actually have a lot of respect for.
Right? Oh, yeah, he's terrible. Well, he's been terrible in the homeless.
You were part of a campground, the Coral Street Open Air Shelter, where you were living in November and December of 1995. What happened there?
Well, we were there for 7.5 months, and we got, 350 tickets that we know of. I think it was actually more than that.
Actually, I'm not talking about the City Hall Sleepers protest, which followed. I'm talking about the period beforehand when you were living at Coral Street in the campground. Tell us about the campground.
Oh, the campground was a safe place for homeless people to be, and we had medical facilities close by. And I actually myself helped save the... Well, you were there that day, you know.
Tell us about it.
Yeah. Well, a girl... had accidentally drank some medical solution instead of water. She thought it was water, and she drank it, and evidently it paralyzed her and everything else, and she almost died. And because the medical facility was right close by, I ran over there real fast. And on the way, I remembered one of the homeless persons was a male nurse at one time, so I got him to go there first. And as I was running by, and then I got a nurse from the clinic there, and they saved the girl's life, you know.
This wasn't someone you knew intimately, this person, right?
Yeah, I did. I knew her very
well. Oh, you did know her very well.
Yeah, I knew her very well. She was a very upbeat young lady, you know,
Well, the reason I ask is, do you think that part of the, and I'm really giving you a leading question,
right,
but don't let me lead you. But
yeah, because I haven't talked about this in a long time.
Right, let me just ask you, though, if they had not been in a community, if they'd been in an isolated camp, would it have been more dangerous?
That's the point. That's the whole point right there, is that she would have been dead for sure. If she would have been out, like, say, along the riverbank, like so many people have been at the riverbank and died since then, because they don't have a place to go because there's limited beds in the satellite program for...
You mean limited spots on the floor, don't you, Dan?
Right. On the church's floors, and very limited. And
I always hate it when you hear that word bed. It gives, you know, big canopy bed.
Right,
no, I think
not. No, it's a hard floor. Right. And but many people have died, you know, because it may be... Yeah, sure. A portion of homeless people are alcoholics and addicts, and of course they're going to have problems with alcohol and drugs, and... sometimes take too much or whatever, but like so many people that we knew there at the homeless back 40 lot back there,
the Coral Street open air shelter.
Yeah, right. They're dead now because we took care of each other when we had that back 40. But when they're out along the canal, I mean the river here, or behind some business or something, and no one's there, the person's gonna die. You know, if you got a little bit too much drugs or, but when we were in there, we could. You know, we all knew what was going on at all times. You know,
you were part of a group, Save Our Shelters, that was sort of the local campers that were part of that back 40 kind of got together and resisted the attempt of the authorities to say get out.
Right, we did. We thought we were going to be able to stay there.
You actually got a month and a half beyond the time they told you to leave, right?
Right, and then they kicked us out and made it.
Was Scott Kennedy involved in that?
Oh, yeah, he was top cop. You know, we considered him the top cop at that time. Because
it was Mayor Mike Rutkin, but it was
right.
Yeah, but Scott Kennedy was on the council.
Yeah, he said that he was going to come in, you know, with the cops and get us out of there. And then the cops came and told us ahead of time that they were going to come in and they were going to evict us out of there, no matter how they had to do it. You know,
now wasn't this a violation of an agreement that the Citizens Committee for the Homeless and Daryl Darling and Paul Merceau had formed with your organization, Save Our Shelter, that they were not going to move on the campground until January 1st or 10 days after the community house project began?
Right. They did. They went back on their word. They didn't follow through with what they said they were going to do. And then they kicked all of us out, like, what is it, about 10 days before Christmas or a few days before Christmas?
And they sent you to New Brighton Beach. Weren't you happy to have that wonderful state
in
park?
In the middle of the winter. Yeah, and then they sent us to the New Brighton Beach. And because we were all so scared, especially the people that had couples and kids and stuff like that, we were so scared.
Dogs.
We took the deal. Yeah, we took the deal. Like dogs, too, because there's no place for people to take their dogs when they're homeless, you know, that in any kind of shelter or anything. And so we ended up out there. And
we're called the River Street Refugees?
We were pretty much, River Street Refugees. We were pretty much forced to take the deal because if everybody was, like one guy, for instance, he was about to get some money and get a big van and stuff, and it was going to be his, like, his savior, you know. But if he didn't have a place to go, he wasn't going to be, for some reason or other, he wasn't going to be able to get that van. And
I know you had Michael Sheridan was sort of doing some leadership in that campground group of the River Street Refugees.
Right.
You had other folks there. But I remember you came to city council some months later, and you accused certain city council members, I believe it was Rodkin and Kennedy, of being responsible for the deaths of people after the closing of the Coral Street Open Air Shelter, which was the campground, the only legal campground in Santa Cruz for homeless people that Kennedy and Rodkin closed in December of 1995.
Right, that's true. And the reason I say that, you know, a lot of people say, oh, well, it's not their fault, you know, that these people... But see, it's just like I was saying back earlier, is that... because we had medical facilities and because our tents were so close to each other, it was almost impossible for us not to know what each other was doing at any one given time, even in the middle of the night, 3 o'clock in the morning, you know? And so Did
anyone ever die at the Coral Street Open Air Shelter of a drug overdose or anything like that?
I don't recall that at all, no.
I recall one woman having a drug overdose, but she was near enough. Maybe this was the woman you spoke of.
Oh, yeah, right.
And she didn't die. She went into a coma, and they got her out of it, as I remember.
Right, yeah. She's up north now with her parents. I kept visiting her after that happened, you know. And now she's up north.
This is another woman than the one you mentioned, or the same one?
No, it's the same woman. Yeah,
no,
same woman.
But you said that numerous people died afterward, after Rodkin and Kennedy forced everyone to leave the camp.
Right, like, for instance, Billy. He was a tall guy, and he was a pretty darn nice guy, you know. But he did have an alcohol problem, and he died right behind a thrift store over there on Front Street. And that was after the shelter closed, and we didn't have no place to go after that, after we went to the state parks and stuff. And he died out there right behind the thrift store. He choked on his own vomit, you know, probably from drinking too much that night or something. That other guy under the bridge got stabbed in the head. He was a homeless person who frequented the shelter also, and he got stabbed right in the head, you know, and killed under the SoCal Bridge, I think it was.
How many people would you estimate died as a consequence of the closing of that shelter?
Oh, I think, first months after it closed, I think there was something like, about 13 people died right away, you know, within a short period of time. And I don't know how many, but...
Did you use the word murderer with respect to Kennedy and Rodkin?
Yeah, I think so. Probably so. Yeah, I'd probably use those
would
words.
You still hold by that position or not?
Yeah, definitely. Rodkin said one time in the city council, said, I don't know if we can really take that responsibility that we're responsible for those deaths, you know. But it's pretty obvious that if during the time that the shelter was up, that nobody died, and then all of a sudden it closes and all kinds of people are dying within the first year, you know. The evidence is right there, you know. Is it their fault or isn't it their fault? It is their fault, you know.
In the months that followed this, you protested the Page Smith Community House building, or actually trying to get a permit to build. They didn't actually start building on the property until 17 months later.
Right.
But you went to city council with my able assistance, I might add.
Right, and you spoke against
the putting of this very expensive transitional shelter that serves 40 people on a site that previously served several hundred, right?
Right. And now I heard even that there's even less than what they said that they were going to, I think each trailer was supposed to hold a certain amount of people. And now I heard today from another person that they don't hold that amount that they originally agreed to, so it's got like hardly anybody in there, really. And I think it was supposed to be 8 people to every trailer. And from what I understand today, that there's way less than that. And also favoritism was used in the people that went into those trailers. Staff people were given first priority into getting into
maybe
that.
Karen Gillette's Homeless Services Center?
Yeah.
The Homeless Community Resource Center,
people,
was that called?
People who worked on the shelter area there, yeah.
And in March of 1996, after seeing this process, seeing people die because of the closing of the Coral Street Open Air Shelter 3 months before, you and Sean Alimi began... It became a very long, nightly, 24-hour vigil at City Hall. Is that right?
Yeah, you got a photographic memory, Robert.
I was taking notes.
Anyway, yeah.
Great fame.
And we started the protest, I forgot what the date was. Oh, March 1st. March 1st.
1996.
Yeah, and by March 4th, they moved in to arrest all of us.
But you didn't go away.
No, we didn't. And we stayed there for 7.5 months, and we got at least 350 tickets, I think. And some of them we didn't know, we didn't have records of, you know. But and then we went to court for, a long time after that.
What was your objective in this protest?
Well, mine was that it was a humanitarian effort to try to save lives, because before they even closed down the Back 40, I went to the council several times and told them that if they closed down, I told them like this, you know, I'm thinking there's only going to be one person that dies, right? I told them, I know if you close that shelter down, then I described some of the people's disabilities that they had. Some of those people were really disabled. And I says, someone's going to die if you close that shelter down. And it was like I was predicting something, you know, before it ever happened. And it was true. You know, all kinds of people died. And that's what the humanitarian effort, as far as I was concerned, is that's what I was doing. I was trying to not allow the situation to happen that would cause people to die, you know.
So were you looking for a new campground? Were you looking for ending the sleeping ban, both?
Mainly we were looking for a new camping ground, but we also wanted to end the sleeping ban so that would free up everybody to, you know, kind of sleep.
More legally and more safer.
Legally and without, and you know, I slept so many times in a rainstorm with just a tarp on me. And it's so miserable, especially in a serious rainstorm, you know. And just laying on the ground, not being able to sleep, just from the noise that hit the tarp, the rain hitting the tarp, you know. And freezing cold and all this stuff. And then you have to worry. And see, I always slept like almost like with one eye open. If I heard one sound, I would be out of there and standing up right away in the middle of the night, you know, right out of sleep, you know, because I attuned myself to, you know, because you never know if it was going to be a white supremacist that hates homeless people that come and beat your ass, or the cops were going to come and beat your ass, you know, or what was going to happen. You didn't know what was going to happen.
White supremacists, they hate black people and Jews. They don't hate homeless.
Oh, yeah, they hate homeless people, too.
Oh, really?
Right here in Santa Cruz, they do. Yeah. Yeah, a white supremacist has already gone to jail several times for beating up homeless people.
Aaron Birch.
He's the leader.
Aaron, that sounds like a Jewish man.
Yeah.
I don't think he's Jewish. But what Mayor Rotkin went to the courts to get an injunction against your protest and was partially successful, though he wanted to close off City Hall at night and was unable to do it.
Right.
Instead, he made it so that one ticket for sleeping would result in a misdemeanor prosecution punishable up to 6 months in jail and a $1,000 fine.
Yeah.
Did anybody ever get any such tickets after that? I think they just kept sort of keep giving infraction tickets. They never used the injunction.
Oh, no, actually, maybe my memory doesn't serve me right, but I thought some people were arrested under that injunction.
Sean Alini was arrested before the injunction in May and held in jail repeatedly. He was your co-founder and the head of Feed the People before he died a year later in a tragic automobile accident. But he was held in jail because he kept announcing his determination to go back and continue the protest. And you, in fact, continued to stay there, staying awake at all odds.